From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Tensions between the U.S. and Venezuela continue to rise, with the U.S. imposing sanctions against that South American nation. For more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype Monday.
The latest news from Venezuela is that the government's response to the sanctions announced last week by President Trump, which are targeting, in a very broad way, Venezuela's ability to participate at all in the international financial structures, which are obviously dominated by Wall Street in the United States and Frankfurt and London in the European Union.
You know, we've been talking about this anyway for a good long while in a larger framework. You've got the United States doing this all over the place, sanctions, trying to isolate people. They isolated everyone in the world so successfully that they stand in the room by themselves now. And what they're doing here, you've had China looking, or in any event, sort of stepping in to the role as the next biggest trading partner with Venezuela for oil. After the United States has played that role for so many years. And China has also been going into the quote-unquote banking business, currency business, et cetera. And now what the U.S. is doing is starting to create a basket, to use the term of art, of countries who must go to some alternate banking system because the United States won't let them play. So, it's almost like Trump is helping China organize an alternative global economy.
Yeah, and there are so many ways of looking at it, aren't there? I mean, one way is to look at it as, well, we're back to the Cold War. We're back to the East and the West, mm-hmm. With a slightly different set of variations, but basically the same. Yeah. Because, and as you say, and Venezuela saw this coming. The Venezuelan authorities saw these sanctions coming. And they'd already set up the beginnings of financial arrangements to enable them to overcome the possible sanctions they might suffer, and which they have now suffered, as a result of the actions of the U.S. government. And it seems to me, just as a footnote, it just seems to me very silly to ascribe these particularly to President Trump, because I think all of this would have happened, and probably much faster, under Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, we had the executive order with Obama that treated Venezuela twice. He signed it Venezuela is an existential threat to U.S. national security. I mean, some absurd, reach like that. So, yeah, agreed. This policy is, extra presidential for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, and it's the Monroe Doctrine or the Manifest Destiny Doctrine, no threat to U.S. dominance in the region will be tolerated, looking at the measures taken by President Trump last week in their long historical context, It's interesting how things have changed, because normally you'd expect the European Union to fall into line very quickly and follow up these kinds of sanctions from the United States right. with measures of their own. Right. But that hasn't happened, not so far, as right. I'm aware.
Right.
And as you say, there are these new players in the international economic arena that have already developed their own financial infrastructure.
Right.
Now, and I think that we know that there's a BRICS summit coming up. When is it? The beginning? It's in the next week, next
yeah.
couple of weeks.
Yes, yeah, very
in,
soon.
Somewhere
yeah.
in China, I think. Now, and I think, in past conversations, you and I have noted that there's a very clear division between the behavior within BRICS of China and Russia and the behavior of Brazil, India, and South Africa.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to – it'll be interesting to see how the BRICS summit pans out from that point of view. And Brazil, it's very unlikely that Brazil, India, and South Africa are going to change their sitting on the fence.
Right.
And not even sitting on the fence in the case of Brazil now.
Yeah.
The posture in terms of are they going to decisively move with Russia and China to create alternative financial and trade architecture that will allow them more autonomy and independence from the dominance, the traditional dominance of the United States in global finance and trade.
Right.
And they're just not going to do that. But China and Russia have every incentive to do so.
Right.
And it's not just in terms of what does Venezuela mean for Russia as an oil producer? And if the United States gets control of Venezuela, it'll be like having another Saudi Arabia, because Venezuela has the biggest proven oil reserves in the world, right, bigger than Saudi Arabia's.
Right.
So Venezuela comes under U.S. influence and control and then starts working with Saudi Arabia against the interests of, say, Russia and Iran.
Right.
In international oil and gas markets.
That's an oil and gas, that's right.
Russia doesn't want that.
Of course not.
And Russia does not want that.
Think about the obverse. The obverse is essentially that you have Venezuela and Russia able to coordinate. And, you know, before the capture of Brazil, recapture of Brazil by the U.S., you know, through Temer and all of that, you had the possibility and you had some of the architecture coming into being of Brazil and Russia and Venezuela, you know, as a block of oil producers. Yeah. And also inside the BRICS, just to, because I don't want to let this go past before we do. You know, all right, BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. You have a change of administration and direction with the capture of the presidency in Brazil and the political conditions that prevail there, at least temporarily. You have then Russia, which is more or less in the same place that it was before. You have India, where Modi came in and he was looking like he was going to start working with the BRICS institutions very aggressively and to try to navigate the relationships between Russia and China in a way that didn't have them at odds, in essence, and looking at the stupid border wars and things that they've had, but actually working, the alliance possible out of the two most populous countries, the largest economy, and, a nuclear strategic deterrence. Instead, Modi is now, playing footsie with the U.S. and the EU. So that kind of, we don't know where that leads in terms of developing alternative financial structures as were under development only a year or two ago. And then you've got China. We know where China's going or seems to be going. And then Zuma, who himself, first of all, is, in a very shaky position, and his own, direction both rests on the underlying contradictions that sit under him and his own willingness, as we saw in Libya, for example, to turn even without pressure. So it's a really difficult walk from here to there for the BRICS to say, hey, let's develop an alternative to the existing financial structures that is even in opposition to the U.S. and EU, given how much influence the U.S. and EU have among those five.
Yeah, and China implicitly recognized that the general drift of policy among its BRICS partners by establishing the Asian Investment and Infrastructure Bank,
right,
which is independent of the BRICS structure.
That's right.
The BRICS have their new development bank and their contingency reserve arrangement, which is more or less equivalent to the IMF. But China went ahead and in any case, and set up its own development bank because it was fed up. And this is my interpretation. They seem to be fed up with the delay and foot dragging that they were experiencing in BRICS, which is perfectly natural because how are you going to, how are you going to coordinate quickly initiatives that are at all decisive among five such huge and diverse countries? Right. So they went ahead and set up the Asian Development Bank. But even there, you can see that they're still bending over backwards to try and collaborate with the United States and the European Union, because they've accepted almost all European countries, the major European countries, as partners in the Asian Infrastructure and Development Bank, and they've accepted Venezuela. Now that, you know, that the membership of Venezuela of the Chinese Investment and Infrastructure Bank is a signal, it seems to me, that China, although there's a sense in which the Chinese don't care who they do business with, as long as they get a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Venezuelan opposition, but if the Venezuelan opposition were to come to power, China must recognize, and they'd be fools not to recognize that Venezuela will stay within, very much within, the U.S. area of influence and won't be so open to cooperation with China.
Right.
So neither from the Russian point of view, nor from the Chinese point of view, do they want to see the Venezuelan opposition come to power in Venezuela.
Right. They do understand in the geopolitical sense that, first of all, there is a game afoot that the United States sees China's rise as coming at its own expense in one fashion or another, and thus, you know, it must be smothered in the cradle. So they understand that. You have in Venezuela now a government willing to do business and also willing to stand apart from the United States. That will change, and the nature of the region, you know, the business relationships here, and I'm saying more or less in relation to the Monroe Doctrine and in relation to the United States, changes if Venezuela is flipped. Venezuela has been at the heart of this, you know, rise of Latin America and the Caribbean as an independent player. And we've seen, you know, as this multipolar game has shaken out, we've seen, you know, there was a rise beginning in Africa. There's the rise in Asia, represented by, you know, a number of things, looking at from Republic of Korea, South Korea to Malaysia and others, you know, where, wow, this, you know, big thing is being assembled in Asia. And also in Latin America, it's been a huge thing. And what did they do? When they killed Gaddafi, they installed AFRICOM in Africa. Africa has been, like, taken out of the game, you know, to a large degree. And what was marching pretty steadily towards regional integration and independence in Latin America and the Caribbean has certainly been interfered with the flipping of Argentina and Brazil and Honduras and a number of other places, and the constant state of siege that Venezuela's found itself under. So I think China sees this big game, and they understand it's in their interest to not allow the United States to, you know, to do this. And so they won't do a direct confrontation. They're playing a long game, though, and I think that they will find ways of thwarting it that are gentle and effective.
Yeah, because from China's point of view, they want to maintain diverse energy supplies for their huge energy needs.
Sure.
And so they don't want to end up being dependent on Russia. They don't want to end up being dependent on Iran
or anybody.
They'd rather have good relationships with all the oil producers, including Saudi Arabia, for example. Right. And Venezuela is a very important part of that mix for China. Now, one of the measures that I'm expecting to happen over the next few months is that Panama closes the canal to PDVSA tankers. PDVSA is the Venezuelan state oil company. And I think they'll do that, because Panama is so much under the control of the United States.
Well,
now, what happens at that point will be very, very interesting to see.
Yeah. Now, take a look at the at China's Nicaragua canal in that context.
No. Yes, exactly. So, you know, there's so much in terms of the geopolitics in internationally, this development of what, you know, it has so many similarities to the Cold War, and so much turns on what happens in Venezuela. So then, and if you look at that, What's happened inside Venezuela since why were those measures implemented in Venezuela, for example? That's an important question for people listening to our conversation to get a grip on. The sanctions are a response to what is an indisputable political triumph for the Venezuelan authorities, which happened on July the 30th, when over 8 million people in Venezuela turned out. Nobody seriously disputes that number, despite reports, really incredible reports to the contrary, questioning the integrity of the Venezuela Supreme Electoral Tribunal. The sanctions themselves are a recognition that a majority of the Venezuelan people voted in support the call by President Maduro for a constituent assembly that completely changes the internal political situation in Venezuela and may well lead to an improvement in the economic situation too. Yeah. So much turns in the internal domestic situation for sure. In Venezuela on whether the Constituent Assembly will be able to implement measures that can be enforced in order to stop or at least substantially limit the long-term economic sabotage which the business sectors and commercial sectors that support the opposition in Venezuela have been engaged in for the last, even since before the death of President Hugo Chavez back in 2013.
Right. Yep.
So that is what the sanctions are about, because the elections are coming up, the regional elections for the governors in, I think it's 23 states. It seems very clear to me that these sanctions are also an attempt to intimidate people in Venezuela to vote for the opposition candidates in those elections, with the assumption being that if the Venezuelan opposition can demonstrate a control of sufficient number of states in Venezuela, that will give them a good trampoline going into the elections in 2019.
Yeah, and well, the intimidation attempt is directed at Venezuelan voters in a way, too, that, look, every time you put these people in power, we punish you. If you stop putting them in power, we'll stop punishing you. But you can't go to that well too many times. That's essentially the subtext to the 2015 elections for the National Assembly, and things only got worse, not better.
Yeah, it's amazing how the United States is so brutish and in their strategic thinking. Do what we want or else.
Mm-hmm.
But those days are gone. They're on the way out.
Right.
That Venezuela isn't Nicaragua. It's not a small country that's vulnerable to the kinds of sanctions in the same way that Nicaragua was back in the 1980s.
And not for nothing, look how Nicaragua turned out regardless.
Yeah, but even in the short term, and it seems to me very unlikely that people in Venezuela have certain fundamental characteristics, and one of those characteristics, certainly after, 17 years of Chavismo, and the kinds of policies associated with Comandante Hugo Chavez, they have a strong Bolivarian way of thinking.
Right.
And what does Bolivarian mean? It means strongly nationalist, strongly independent,
right,
determined to make the domestic policy in a way that is in the interests of the people and the nation. And that's absolutely fundamentally opposed to what the United States has just done.
Right. I mean, this is something that arose in reaction to the Monroe Doctrine, in essence, to the practice of it. The need for a strong nationalist glue to societies there was created by the massive exploitation of both the people and the resources of that region by the United States, and the reduction of the systems of government there to accomplice in pushing forward of that agenda.
Yeah, and if the United States could not have done taken a measure more aimed at in creating and developing and inspiring greater Bolivarian reaction.
Right. This is the same dynamic we were just talking about with, you know, as they isolate people economically around the world, they end up creating like an alternate structure of everybody but us.
Right. Let's assume that President Nicolas Maduro, with the support of the Constituent Assembly and a majority of people in Venezuela, manages to at least take some steps that begin to encourage people to believe that there's an end to the economic punishment in sight.
Right.
Because that's what the Venezuelan opposition have done is they've punished their own people with their economic sabotage over the last 3, 4, 5 years, and it hasn't worked. Now, obviously, at some point, people will get exhausted. Has that point been reached? No, it hasn't. If Maduro and his team, and with the support of the Constituent Assembly, are unable to give people a sense that they're on the way out of this long period of economic suffering, if they can do that, there's no way that politically the opposition are going to win. They're not going to make political progress in the regional elections. And that what that means is that between now and the elections in 2019, the presidential elections in 2019, Maduro and his team, the Venezuelan people, the Constituent Assembly is scheduled to work over the next 2 years. It's a two-year program that they have. And that means that President Maduro and his team, both domestically and internationally, have the breathing space, and they'll get more oxygen, in my opinion, once the October regional elections are held, in which they're likely to do they're much better than people think.
Right.
So, and what that means is that US policy will essentially be shown up as a complete failure. The sanctions aren't going to work.
Yeah,
you know, and it's true that Venezuela historically has been overwhelmingly dependent on imports. But look at what happened with the sanctions in Russia. Look at what happened with the sanctions in Iran.
Right.
What both those countries did was rearrange their economy
right. So
as to make the sanctions, if not completely irrelevant, certainly not as serious as they were intended to be.
Yeah, let's look also. I want to look at Nicaragua. It's own history. Ending that kind of a crisis, and the end of the 1980s, early 1990s, and the evolution of things from then forward. I just want to make one correction. I think the Venezuelan presidential election is still scheduled for October of 2018, not 2019, unless they've moved.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. All right. So. So, you had this crisis that was created in Nicaragua by essentially a U.S. invasion based in Honduras and also to a much lesser degree Costa Rica, maybe Pentagon in Honduras and the CIA in Costa Rica, however. This went on. It was a bloody, the Contra War was a bloody war. That, of course, the economy was in shambles as a consequence of it, and there were sanctions against the Sandinista government, and aside from outright war, outright meddling by the United States internally, assassinations, all kinds of things. Then you have the election in 1990, and the outcome was what the West had hoped for. After creating this crisis, they get one of their own elected, Violeta Chamorro. But over time, we end up with Ortega back in power, President Ortega, and the actualizing of the Sandinista Revolution. And Nicaragua now is doing swell, and you can only accept on its face the argument that, and they'd be doing better if the U.S. didn't spend a decade or two, destroying and or looting the country. And people in Venezuela have to see this. And maybe if President Ortega once a week reminded them basically that, well, we went through this too, and here's how we got through it.
Yeah, and none of that was inevitable in Nicaragua.
Of course.
By no means. And so much people in Nicaragua owe so much to the perseverance of Daniel Ortega and his colleagues in the political leadership of the Sandinista Front.
Yeah, also to Venezuela, also to Cuba, to the people, all of the people of Nicaragua, even the petty bourgeoisie ended up coming around, a lot of them.
Yeah, and but they had to go through 17 years of hell.
Hell, absolute hell.
Because the period from 1990 to January 2007, when Daniel Ortega took office again, he didn't take power. He took office, and he was still faced with a 2-3-4 year struggle in order to establish sufficient political autonomy to be able to implement his and his party's political agenda. So, I know you're actually talking about 20 years of essentially of an extremely difficult period that nobody should wish on any society.
I mean, Venezuela is suffering and has been suffering, since they started the attack, really in 2002, with many victories, the housing and medical care and infrastructure development, et cetera. But that, not to negate the suffering of the Venezuelan people, what happened in Nicaragua makes what's happened in Venezuela thus far look almost like a picnic.
Yeah, and there were 50,000 people dead during the 1980s war. And prior to that, there were something like 15,000 people dead in the insurrection against Somoza.
Right.
So, and, terrible suffering in Nicaragua. But as you say, and the nitty-gritty, but that, and that brings us back to other conversations that we've had where we've been talking about much broader regional processes whereby once people have a taste of a decent life, nobody is going to push them back down into the dirt.
That's right.
And that really, that seems to me to be the fundamental message of what's happened in Nicaragua over the last 30 years.
Right.
The impoverished majority in Nicaragua they had access to free healthcare, free education, free university education, all kinds of things that, a modern advanced society should take for granted.
Right. And they saw where it came from. They helped to build it themselves. It happened in a short enough period of time and recently enough so that people both remembered it and nationally, the people remembered it. And, in Venezuela, I just saw this thing go by the other day. We spoke sort of commemorating the day that the 1 millionth housing unit was built a couple of years back. And, this was... housing, 30 million, 31 million people in Venezuela and 20 to 25 million. And, they built 1 million units of housing, a really significant increase in the standard of living of people with this addition to the housing stock. I just saw go by last week a number, and it was like 1.2 or 1.3 million or something. With all that's been going on in Venezuela, They've just been ticking along, continuing to build that housing. People don't walk away from that.
They've managed to maintain 70% of their budget goes on social spending.
I mean, if the U.S. did that, could you imagine?
Maintain that.
If the U.S. did that, I'd be able to take 26 weeks a year off and spend it drinking in Cuba or something. If they spent half the budget that they spend on other stuff on the people.
Right. But the fundamental thing is that same process that took over 20 years in Nicaragua from 1990 to the end of the first decade of the 2000s, that process is much more compressed now in Venezuela. And that's why I think that in the regional elections, people in Venezuela are going to support the government massively, and that means that the government will get a political boost, enabling it to implement its economic program prior to the presidential elections. But that's a long enough time frame for them to get that sorted out.
Then we'll have to stop there, Tony. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Don. Look forward to it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.